You're on duty.
Okay. Pardon?
Remember that night?
Oh, do I?
Jeez.
Hey, everybody, I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. I remember that night vividly, Pete. It was the son of one of our members, too. And he was a Marine, wonderful kid, and we found out that was a night of great coincidence. The coincidence was that I got a call from his uncle in Georgia to go see him. And I said, well, I'm not going to go alone. And I called, where did he go to? Hey, Pete!
Hi, Jerry.
So I called Pete. And the first coincidence, the reason I called Pete is this kid told me he was doing some drugs, too. And I knew that Pete was one of those double dippers. Double dipper. And so I called him and I asked him if he'd come on this with me. And he said, yeah. And I said, where do you live? It was around 27th and Liberty.
Yeah, exactly.
Liberty. This kid was at 28th and Liberty. Wow. As Gene Akery would say, coincidence number one. We picked him up at his house and we went to a meeting. And Pete could tell more than I could that this kid was really quite jittery. So we went out to Mr. Donut.
Yep.
I remember this well.
Yep.
And we had coffee, and we were trying to settle him down. In the middle of the conversation, we were trying to figure out what to do. You know, do we take him home? He was alone, and he was quite jittery. And he said, no, he was going to go home and then walk around the peninsula. Oh, really? So this is cutting into my lead, I want you to know.
You decided to say that.
So Pete gave me a little signal and says, why don't we go over and get some more donuts? So we slide over, and he said, I don't like the way this kid's acting. What should we do? So I went out and got on my cell phone. I called the vet's hospital. I got Dr. Steve, who's in the fellowship. He was on duty that night, coincidence number three. Steve says, bring him up. We take him in. A counselor met us. Steve introduced us to the counselor. The counselor was a counselor in addiction, coincidence number four. We went in the room, and the counselor said to me, you can stay while I interview this young man. And I said, no, I'll go out. You talk to him on your own. And I turned over to Mike, and I said, Mike, you just tell him the truth. And the counselor came out a full half hour later, and he said, guys, I'm glad you brought this young man in here tonight. He was going to take his life. Coincidence number five. And they wanted to get him into detox right away and get him under extremely good care. And they have a wonderful vets facility in Pittsburgh. And they said, well, we won't be able to get him down there till tomorrow morning. Just then the door opened. And the van that runs back and forth between the two hospitals pulled up, and the guy said, I didn't have a lot to do tonight, so I thought I'd come back tonight and run down again tomorrow morning. Coincidence number six. They put him in the van. He was under care in Pittsburgh at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, that's the way this program works. And when Denny was reading about God and everything, you know, that's where I find my higher power, in things like that, in great things that occur among us all the time that I would have taken for coincidence before, but no longer. Did I say I was an alcoholic?
I think so.
I say that because I was searching for a definition when I first came in. I wasn't certain that I belonged here. And to be very honest with you, there are occasions when I tempt myself today, even though it was 1982 when I came in the door. I haven't been around that long because I had a couple slips. But I love to romance the drink. Anyway, I was looking for a definition that would help me stay here. And Ike got up at the Lawrence Group and gave a lead. And he said, I'm an alcoholic because I can't honestly predict for you what I will do next if I take a drink. And that was sufficient for me. It, you know, the tumbler went, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. You know, when I, sometimes I like to get a little flippant when I talk. It's my nature. And I introduce myself as a Gaelic, that's Irish. I'm not coming out, folks. I introduce myself as a Gaelic, Catholic, manic, diabetic, neurotic, alcoholic. And there's probably a lot of other things in there, too. And the reason I mention that is because my experience in the fellowship is that most of us have a lot of problems that go beyond alcohol. It can be drugs, gambling, anything at all. And also severe emotional problems and mental disorders. And as our chapter 5 says, we can get over these if we have that capacity to be honest. I've been reading through my big book again lately, and I came across something I had never seen Here it is. In the doctor's opinion, good old Dr. Silkworth, our patron saint, he talks about the different types of people that have problems like that. And he said, there is the manic depressive type. I've been diagnosed as that from way back. Who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written? I'm mad at Dr. Silkworth. They did not write that chapter. I mentioned that to a friend of mine the other day, and he said, well, you'll have to. And I thought, that's the perfect AA answer, isn't it? Put it right back on the guy that complained. Like, you know, you complain about the donuts, you're going to get them next week. I also want to mention that one of the things that also helped me clear up a lot of things in my head when I came in was that there's a line in the book that says, alcohol is but a symptom of our disease. And that made so much sense to me, you know, that there are so many other things that rattle on that contribute to your alcoholism that may have been a root cause or just things to be aware of, character defects to learn about, things like that, that are so important to understanding ourselves in the process of knowing what an alcoholic is. I usually try to touch a little bit on my early life in my lead, which I haven't done in some time except for a little rattle session I had at Hammett recently. But when I first came in, my first leads I heard were at the Lawrence Group, and everybody, it seemed like most of the people, talked a little bit about their childhood when they first got up, you know, a little bit about their upbringing and things like that. And I thought, what the hell are they doing that for? You know, get into the guts of it. But then I realized after some time that those patterns of our life are developed early on. And you don't have to put your head down. This is being recorded, my God. Honey, I didn't mean a thing by that. My wife's probably going to hear this thing. Anyway, I was born into, I would call it a beautiful middle-class family. My father was a very prominent public figure. My mother was a sweetheart. Three children. I have an older sister and a younger brother. Both of them died within the past 2 years of dementia, Alzheimer's disease. I don't know whether that makes me a candidate for that or not, but at age 80, I'm feeling as though I got a long time to go. And I'm still fairly sharp for my age. I was born on Christmas Day, 1930, and someone said, why? And I said, well, I wanted to be near my mother that day. I've also told people that when I came down the birth canal, and this is where fear comes in, I think I might have said, I don't want to come out. Because that's kind of like the way I felt, out of sorts. As far back as I can remember, I was a scared little boy. And it turned out that there was probably some fairly good reason for that. I was a cute little kid, like they tell me. I had hair and everything. And I can't remember much about my childhood. It's quite, there's nothing vivid in there, except a few occasions, like I had a beautiful soprano voice, and they were training me to sing the Panis Angelicus, for midnight mass. And my parents would get me up when they had company in, 2 o'clock in the morning, and say, "Oh, here's Jerry, he's going to sing Panis Angelicus for you." And I would stand there quivering and do the Panis Angelicus, hit the right notes, and then turn around and shag my way up the stairs real quick. Those are things I remember. It's funny how you do remember that. I did have a great voice at one time. They wanted me to go to vocal training, but not this guy. Anyway, I went into school, and I did not do well at all. It turned out that they sent me to school in 1935. They thought I was somewhat precocious. So I was 5 years old, and I'm in first grade. Don't ever make that mistake if you got a baby or a young one coming up. Don't ever make that mistake. Hold a child back rather than push him ahead too early. And I'm sure the counselors today would say that, but I'm living proof that that's not a good thing to do. I always ran around feeling she still got her head down.
Look at him crawl.
That's what we need during this league, dialogue. It turned out that I couldn't keep up in class, and they thought I was fairly alert and what was going on. Well, they did not know in 1935, and they didn't know for some time, what ADD was. I ended up being in 4 grade schools in 8 years. They kept, my father would say, "Well, that's not, it must be the school's fault, you know. Move them to another school, and then move them to another school, and move them to another school." And so there I was chasing my tail and scared to death and no chance of becoming the kind of a man that I respect when I see people today that are real men. I did not have that chance. I didn't think I had that chance. And for a good part of my life, I believed that I didn't have that chance. The chance that helped me believe that was alcohol. Alcohol, when I drank, when I eventually started to drink, which was not real early in my life, gave me that certain confidence that I could do things that I never imagined. And I became a man around town and drank a bit and never drank alcoholically until I was probably in my mid-40s. I drank a lot, but I didn't drink alcoholically. I went to the prep school and just got out of there on luck. A couple of priests and nuns, who people criticize a lot from this platform, helped me survive. They stayed behind and taught me. They did some wonderful things to help this guy out. I will always be indebted to those men and women. And I like to say it out loud so everybody hears that. I got my knuckles wrapped too, but it was all out of love. I know that today. Those priests and nuns loved the boys down there. I remember Sister Teresa Marie used to get together with us on Monday morning, and that's when they were cloistered, those nuns. She was a mercy nun. And they weren't allowed out on the weekends, and we'd have a football game on Friday or Saturday night. On a Monday morning, the first thing she'd say was, "How did our boys look Saturday night? How did Charles do out there? How did Timmy do out there?" And that's when I knew. I always had that intuitive nature to dig into what a person kind of like was. And I knew that that lady, that beautiful nun, loved us boys. And those are the kind of people that helped me get through school. I don't know why I'm dwelling on that. It just kind of pops into my head. Anyway, I was also fortunate that the one good thing I could do in school was write. I had the natural Irish creativity to write. You know, people that are manic depressive, dual addicted, as they say. I remember, who was our old buddy that about dual? Used to go to the meetings, Todd. He was the.
Where do you go? What meeting?
Oh, McCain mostly. Merle. Merle went down to the Boston store, he was a bachelor, to buy a electric blanket. And they were new out, and the clerk said to him, do you want a dual electric blanket? And he said, I don't got nobody to duel with. You had to know Merle. You know, I love this fellowship so much. Those are the kind of people that just stand out for me. But anyway, the manic depressive thing, I looked it up and went down through the, on the computer. If you look up that subject and say, who was famous in history that was manic depressive, you get an incredible number of people. Julius Caesar, Abraham Lincoln, Buzz Aldrin. If you're into great writing, Josh Logan. The list goes on and on and on. Usually people that write or are somewhat creative. So I felt that, well, I fit there too. Anyway, because I had that talent, I'd been a copy boy at the paper, and they offered me a job to become like an apprentice reporter. And at age 17, I was an apprentice reporter at the Erie Times. I graduated from high school that year. And I'd been a copy boy, so they kind of like took me in. And I was a reporter at the Times for the next 12 years, learning on the job, and always, though, looking behind me, wondering when I was going to get caught up with, when people were going to find out that Jerry really, essentially, was a fraud. That's the way I felt about myself. And again, luckily, I got a job in a radio station across the street. They wanted somebody to do news in the evening, and they wanted a name that would be recognizable by people other than just a news personality. So they hired me because my byline was in the paper all the time. And then along comes an offer from Channel 35 Television, and I became an anchor for the early news at Channel 35. I did that for 5 years. And at about this, a little bit before that, I met the woman who was to become my wife, my sweet Adriana. Incidentally, she told me if I talk tonight to say thanks to all of you for the prayers that she has received. She's doing beautifully well. Thank you. And really, like they say in here, I took a hostage. God has watched out for me so much in my life. I mean, I lucked into the job at the paper. I lucked into the job at the television station. I lucked into getting married to her. And the day I was married, I said, what the hell am I doing this for? You know? Well, within 6 years, I found out we had 5 sons. That'll help your drinking improve. Anyway, I ended up working at the paper, doing the early news, doing the late news, and after the late news, I'd go out. And I'd drink quite heavily and get home in time to get up the next morning, get a couple hours sleep, and go back down to the paper at 6:30 in the morning, pick up the overnight police reports, report the news all day, go back up, do the television, do the radio. And I got pretty sick. And I went to see a doctor who I was to see 30 years later. And he said to me, you don't need me. You need a psychiatrist. You're killing yourself. You're under so much tension and pressure. You need to consolidate those jobs. And I said, well, I need the income. I got my 5 little boys. And I was always worried about being able to provide for my family. The thought of abandoning them, I don't think it ever occurred to me, except at the tail end of my drinking when I didn't care where they were. So, again, I got a phone call from a gentleman who was the chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Committee, and he said they wanted a guy to work with Governor Lawrence in Harrisburg helping with industrial development. Another subject I knew nothing about. And so I went to work there. I ended up being a plant location man, going out in the, you know, Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, New York, everywhere where we'd get a nibble on an ad we might run. And I'd work with those people and try to get them to locate their plant in Pennsylvania. And we had some good success with that. That was a very big thing in the 1960s. When the employment rate was in Pennsylvania was higher than it is today. It was around 12%, 9.3 today, which isn't good at all. Our goal was always to get it to 5, so you can see how bad things are right now. I feel badly for the people that are out of work right now. It's tragic. Anyway, I worked for the governor, and the fellow I worked with was Bill Davlin, PhD, economist from the state of Wisconsin. And the day I met him, I knew I'd met a friend. He had a bottle in his desk. And at lunchtime, I used to go up and drink with Bill. And within 2.5 years, we buried that man of acute alcohol poisoning. I never even saw it coming. I just thought, well, he's a heavy drinker. And one day he went in the hospital and he never came out. I had an uncle who was doing, in that process of doing the same thing, and I said to myself, he's just a weakling. Why can't he straighten out and do the right thing? I thought he was a weakling. And I often said to myself, if I knew then what I know now, could I have made a difference? And the answer is, only God could have. And he didn't choose to in those cases. Or maybe it's just that he wasn't given that opportunity. I don't know, and I don't need to ask, really. So anyway, the state changed administrations, and they threw all the Democrats out. And there I am sitting at home without a job, and I get a call, John Cochran, Lyons Transportation. I became assistant to the president. I didn't know a truck, a diesel, a double axle, a road rage and transmission. I didn't know anything about trucking, except you picked something up and took it somewhere. Hopefully, unless you wanted a lot of OS&D, that means over, short, and damaged, hopefully to a location you were supposed to take it to. And that's what I knew about trucking. I was in that for 12 years. Things went a little sour then. And I'm into drinking pretty good now, because one of the things I did with the Cochran guys was I traveled from city to city running hospitality rooms, hospitality houses, having functions, you know, getting big-time sports celebrities out to come at our parties, and cock of the walk. And I started to drink very heavily. And I could get away with it pretty well. I didn't get too badly bent out of shape. And the times that I did, I was with guys who wanted to get bent right with me. So it didn't bother anybody. Everybody else would go to bed, and I'd always find a traffic manager somewhere, and he and I'd finish off the booze and struggle to our beds. I always was able to get up fairly early and get back on my feet. Again, God in my life, I was out of a job Christmas time, 1976. Oh, I got to back up a minute. I had switched my drink during this period of time, the last 10 years, to Manhattan's on the Rock. Not the rocks, rock. Not too much displacement. And I used to gurgle those things down. I'm telling you, I could go out to dinner and have 10 or 12 of them and drive home. I once went out with a gal who was visiting from the coast. She'd been my high school sweetheart, and I drank 11 Manhattans on the Rocks because they called me the next day to tell me, because I hadn't paid my bill. I just walked out drunk as a loon and drove home and made it to the house. Terrible. Anyway, oh God, I better get moving here. Anyway, the wheels were coming off, and I wasn't feeling good at all, and I called this doctor friend that 25 years before had told me I needed a psychiatrist. He gave me some tests because I told him I wasn't feeling well at all. And he called me in and he said, Jerry, I've run the tests, and the only thing I see here is that you have a little problem with your liver. And the old, how many do you drink? Oh, a couple. And he said, well, he didn't belabor the point, and I knew Charlie pretty good, Charlie Joy. He's a wonderful guy. And he said, he knew me well. And he said, well, would you do a little experiment with me? And I said, yeah, what is it? He said, can you go a month without taking a drink? And I said, I've done it a lot. I used to go on the wagon all the time after a particularly bad siege. I'd quit. That's it. Never going to do it again. And so we did a little test, and he redid it in a month, and then the needle moved a little, and he did it after 2 months, and the needle moved a little. He said, let's keep going. 3 months. Within 4 months, the liver had already begun to respond to. So he said, well, we've identified the problem. You agree? And I said, I guess so. And he said to me, the one thing you should never say to an alcoholic, and I've told him this since, well, you should never take a drink again as long as you live. I mean, that's a death sentence to somebody that wants to drink, and it gets so much mental and physical relief from it. And and he said something, too, that I found out in our book later. He said, you know, some people have an allergy to alcohol. You're one of those people. The more you consume, whether you get drunk or not, you're doing damage to yourself every time you take a drink. I believed in listening to authority. I always did in my life. I was afraid of authority most of my life. And so I listened to Charlie. And I went for 7 or 8 months without taking a drink, and Christmas was coming. And I always used to do a nice job Christmas week on Manhattan's. I had a pitcher going all the time. And I called him up Christmas Eve, and I said, Charlie, you know, tomorrow's my birthday. He said, oh, good, happy birthday. I said, you know, I always like to have a little wine with Christmas meal. And the whole family's going to be gathered, and we do a little toast. And I haven't had a drink in 8 months. I'm listening to what you say. A glass of wine certainly wouldn't be bad. And he said, Jerry, when you drink, you drink at your peril. That's all I want you to know. Excuse me if you got bad ears or good ears. I said to him, Merry Christmas, you son of a bitch. And I hung up the phone. I did not take a drink Christmas. I didn't take a drink in January. February comes around. I had a bright thought, like the bulb that goes off in the cartoons. Ah, yes, I got another doctor. He gave me the tests. I said, how does it look on for this and this? Oh, he said, everything looks good. I said, what do you advise your patients about drinking? Oh, he said, I have a drink occasionally. He said, if I'm not on duty, if it's my weekend, he said, I'll have a couple of beers maybe on a Saturday, or beer when I'm cutting the lawn on Sunday. Maybe a glass of wine at dinner every once in a while. And I said, oh, really? So it wasn't, I didn't leave his office and run straight to a bar. But the next day I stopped in and had a draft. I can't even remember where I stopped. Can't even remember. It might have been the Antlers. Well, we closed that one, didn't we? That's gone. But anyway, I stopped and I had one beer and left. Went in a few days later, had two beers and left. And you know how it goes. Before long, the beer was gone, the Manhattans were back, and I was starting to act up again. While all this was happening, I was out of a job. Things had gone really bad. And God, again, I'm sitting at home, Christmas week, really in a manic low, I mean, unbelievable depression. And I said to my, Adrian, I said, well, aren't you going to go out and start looking for a job? And I said, yeah, I'll get around to it. And I said, there's one place I might go and ask for a job. She said, where? I said, Hammett Hospital. I said, their PR has not been good. I read bad stuff about them. Nobody gives them a break. Maybe I could do well down there or help them out. January 2nd, the phone rang. My wife answered the phone, and she put her hand over the thing, and she goes, you're not going to believe it. I said, what? She said, it's Mr. Ennis from Hammett Hospital. He wants to talk to you. Picked up the phone. It's Bill Ennis. Mr. Ennis, Jerry Haggerty, how are you? Well, we're planning to make a few changes with our communications down here, and we'd like to know if you'd like to interview. We're going to have opening for a pretty good job down here. And I said, well, yes, do you want to get together? And he said, yes. And I said, wait till I check my calendar. January through July didn't have much on it. And anyway, I got the job. I mean, unbelievable. Now I went from newspapers that I didn't know anything about to television and radio to trucking, now to hospitals. I don't know anything about it. So anyway, there I was, chasing my tail, and never feeling quite comfortable, but realizing after I got in here how gifted I'd been by my higher power, who had kind of like kicked me along like a can in an alley, trying to get me out where it was sunshine. And that's been the story of my life. I told you earlier that I didn't take a drink when I first came in. I went 14 years in the fellowship and didn't take a drink. I did not do it right. I belabored doing a fourth or fifth step. And when I finally got around to it, the first glancing blow I took at it, I recognized that I had carried that stuff around in my head so long that I knew it word for word. It was all bad, bad jury, bad, bad jury. I had no concept of what I was supposed to do or handle it, or no good points to put down on my resume, as they say. And I also did a glancing blow. I went out to Hazelden for one of their weekend retreats and did a fifth step with a counselor out there. I might just as well have been talking to a wall. It meant nothing to me, nothing. And that same year, after 13, 14 years, Gene Akery died that year, October 1995. He was my guardian angel, like the lady I'm going to tell you about in a minute was. And my guardian angel died. She was a young girl from Argentina who had come to be an exchange student in our home, Gabriela Rojo. She was the prettiest, most perceptive little 17-year-old you ever saw. No bigger than a minute. Beautiful girl. Spoke four languages. One morning after a particularly bad weekend, and I want to get into all the details of my drinking, but I was off the wall. I was bizarre. I had developed the morals of a lobo wolf. I would do anything when I drank. You know, I was embarrassing my family. And it was a Sunday morning, and we'd gone up to St. Bonaventure, where my son was head of his class, and I embarrassed him throughout the university with my antics. And it's Sunday morning, and somehow we got home, and I'm sitting in my big chair, you know, the big macho chair, with the newspaper up, and my family's all dressed, and they're going out to Mass, which we did every Sunday. And I wasn't going anywhere that day. I couldn't move. And this little Gabriella stuck her head around the corner. And she said, Dad, can I? I asked her to call me Dad. It came out Dud. But she said, but she said, Dud, can I ask you a question? And I said, what do you want? She said, why do you hate yourself? There's no answer to that. It's a revelation. And I guess I'd known that I did. I did. I couldn't stand what was inside of me. And then when I come in, to forestall doing a good fourth and fifth was such an ugly thing, as I think back on it now, because a lot of that could have gone away so much earlier. But that's what she said to me. That was in 1981. I came into the fellowship in 82. And in 95, when Gene died, that was a shock to me. Then I got a call that Christmas before we went to Europe that Gabriela had been killed in an auto accident with her son in Buenos Aires. It was just like your own daughter, you know. It felt so keen. I felt that so keenly. We had five boys. I always wanted to have a little girl. So I said, if we get an exchange student in here, it's going to be a girl. And I'm surprised they let her come to my home. If it weren't for my wife, it wouldn't have worked out. She looked after her so well. But I love that little girl. So now she's dead, Jean's dead. I'm going to Europe. And I knew before I left that I was going to take a drink. So I go over there, and I went a couple days without a drink, and then I took some drinks. Now, here's the interesting thing. I've had two or three slips in my career. I have never gotten drunk. I couldn't. I was drinking a few Manhattans, and I went to a function at one of my wife's uncle's houses in London. Really great spot. And he's got this magnificent wine cellar. And he was opening bottles and putting them out. This is, you know, Ugage, what you haul. This is 19. I don't need the year. And when they were all out in the garden, I'm in there throwing down these bottles of wine. I drank as much wine as you can drink. I mean, just kept drinking. Nothing. I didn't feel a thing. My wife came up to me after about 45 minutes of this, and she said, you know, I know you've been drinking, but you're not getting drunk. And I said, I know it. I wanted to get to that spot that we all love, you know, the one there. If you told me I could go out there and get there tonight, I'd be in the parking lot. I wouldn't be in here. If I thought I could get to that spot and stay there, why be here? That's my attitude. But I couldn't get there. And my wife, God love her again, she said, you know, God doesn't want you to drink. Haven't you figured that out? She said, we're going home tomorrow. So we changed our plans, and we got on a plane. We came home, and I walked in here Tuesday night and sat right back there. And I got up and reintroduced myself, and I felt like such an ass. But that's when any spiritual growth that I've experienced began. Since that time, I had a couple of occasions when I, and this is a warning to you, I have a sleep disorder that Bruce and I were talking about. I'm doing something about it right now. And I would take an Ambien tablet, which is a pretty powerful sleep inducer, but instead of taking it and going to bed, I'd take it and sit in my chair for a while. Well, after a while, everything gets a little different. Matter of fact, one night I went and got some popcorn. You could see it all around the house like a little kid spilling. You knew exactly where the kid had come from and where he was going. And there's stuff was spilled all over the place. I'd go to the refrigerator. There was a drink in there. Throw it down. And the first time I did that, I threw up all over the refrigerator and all over the wall. I couldn't keep it down. It was that bad. I did that one more time. And each time, I made the phone call and told the guys what was going to happen. And Bruce came over that one day. Bruce and Kevin and Lauder and Jerome were all there that morning. And they gave me holy hell, which, incidentally, I did not need. I was giving myself enough hell. But, you know, it's always been a blow to my ego not to be able to get up at a meeting and say, I've been in AA for 29 years. I desperately want to do that. I wanted to be an old-timer and get up out of Buzz's place and say, I'm an old-timer. I know what that is today. That's my ego. And the reason I elaborate on it tonight is because maybe it'll do somebody some good. I got much more active in the program than ever after my major slip. And the other two I consider tiny blots on the escutcheon. Not really too bad, and thank God they didn't go any further. And I know today that they were induced by a drug. And it's not a healthy one if you don't take it under prescription and do it as the doctor told you. Now, if I have to take a drug like that, I take half of one and go to bed right away, and it works. As I say, I have a sleep problem, and I am dealing with it. I'm hoping to get off any of that stuff. But I do it under doctor's orders, and it works. I had a dear friend named Joe Lacone. I don't know how many of you may remember Joe. He's long dead. I was privileged to speak at his funeral. Again, just because I was in this fellowship. And Joe used to do the news anchor at Channel 12 television, and we used to be competitors years ago. But we were good friends and golfing buddies. Joe was pretty much a non-drinker. He'd have a glass of wine at Christmas or something. The kind of guy you want to grab and take his head and put it in his eggs every morning. Damn you, Joe. How can you do that? And he asked me on more than one occasion what AA was like. And I said to him, Joe, how do you tell somebody what AA is like? You know, I find it impossible to do. Well, one Saturday morning, not too long after that, I was listening on PBS. They used to do great Saturday morning interviews with celebrities. And they were interviewing the old redhead, famous sports announcer.
Red Barber.
Red Barber. The old Red Barber. Beautiful man. And they said to him in the interview, what's the greatest thing? Because he covered everything in sports. And they said, what's the greatest thing you ever saw in all your time of 50 years covering sports? Was it the 4-minute mile? Was it this? Was it that? No. No, he said it was when I was out at Notre Dame not a spectator, but a participant in the Special Olympics they had there that summer. And he was working one of the finish lines holding up the ribbon for these kids that would run around the track. And he was on this one particular race, and he said the gun goes off and the kids start to run around the track. And there was this one little boy. And I like to say that when you look out upon them, these are people with problems. These kids are people with problems. I can identify with that. And they're running around the track, and this one little kid, before they even got halfway around, was already 20 yards out in front of the rest of the group. And he kept inching forward and forward, more and more. Now he's 30, 35 yards ahead. He makes the big turn. He's heading for home. There were thousands of people in the stands that day. And they started to rise and cheer for this kid. And he started to shake. And he shook, and his legs got wobbly. He got about 20 yards from the finish line, and he fell right down flat on his face. And the other kids behind him came up. They all stopped. They picked him up. And they finished together. And I said to Joe, Joe, that's the best thing I can tell you about our fellowship. That's what we do for one another. I've been picked up by these people, and I've picked up other people. And that's what we do. And our goal is to finish together, and we think we're going to a good place. Thanks a lot. Thank you.